Let's pick up where we left off yesterday in Genesis chapter 14, verse number 5, which is describing an invasion of Canaan by a four-king Mesopotamian alliance to resecure their control over the cities of the plain, that'd be Sodom and Gomorrah and their associated cities, that were very likely located where the north basin of the Dead Sea now exists. At that time, before the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, the Jordan Valley was very lush. It was referred to at that time as the Valley of Cultivated Fields. And Moses says that it had been described as like the Garden of Eden, like the Nile Delta, which is not what it looks like today. So something drastic happened and changed the geophysical look of the region, and I think that's the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. So these kings had taken control 14 years earlier, and they had for 13 years brought into their coffers all the wealth of the grain and the fruit and the vegetable and the bitumen tribute that they'd been receiving from this region. But in the 13th year, nothing came in. So here in the 14th year, which I believe is 2091 BC, that's when they decide they're going to get this back under their control. And as they take the King's Royal Highway, a very ancient road system, down past Damascus and into the area east of what is the Sea of Galilee now, they start running into problems with giants. And we know that these are giants because the names are used in relationship to giant stories elsewhere in the Old Testament. So let's pick up the story, Genesis 14, verse 5. In the 14th year, Chedorlaomer, so he must be the commander of the allies, and the kings who were with him came, and they defeated the Rephaim in Ashtaroth-Karnaim. Now, Ashtaroth-Karnaim is located somewhere east of the Sea of Galilee. And then the Rephaim in the Greek text is simply the giants. The Hebrew means probably those who sank down. And the word Rephaim gets used in many places as kind of the catch-all term for giants of all sorts, which might explain the next line in the Hebrew. Because it says they also defeated the Zuzim in Ham. And I told you yesterday that this in Ham that we see in English might actually be more properly represented as the Hebrew for in them, which is exactly what the Septuagint, the Greek Old Testament, says at this point. So this is what we know about the Zuzim. Pardon me. The Zuzim means conspicuous ones. And they were the group from which Og came. He was the last of them, which the Israelis are familiar with him, because once they killed him as the last of the of the Rephaim in that area that we're actually talking about right here, they captured his iron bed and kept it on display for a while. And the dimensions given are about 13.5 by 6 feet. So that's one big bed, which indicates he must have been one big guy. So this is 600 some years earlier, and there's a bunch of these giants living in the same general region, and the four-king alliance kills a bunch of them as they pass southward toward their ultimate goal, which is to take back control of the five-city region. So then, from there, the next thing we read is that they also defeated the Emim in Shava Kiriathayim. Now, first of all, let's locate Kiriathayim. That's about 65 miles farther south on the road than what we were at when the first Rephaim were run into. So we're now down into the region to the east of where the Dead Sea starts. So somewhere in that general vicinity. The Emim, their name in Hebrew means the frighteners. So the scary guys. They are definitely part of the Anakim, according to the book of Deuteronomy. And we know that the Anakim were giants. So all these groups that these guys run into first are giant groups living east and northeast of where Sodom and Gomorrah and the other cities of the plain are located. Now, why do I associate that? Because we know that Sodom and Gomorrah and all of those cities were exceedingly wicked. They were a centerpiece of evil in the world at this particular time. And they will be judged harshly by God by being pretty much annihilated, because there's not even 10 righteous individuals that can be found when you start with Lot and his family as part of that 10 potential. We know that the last time that we had such a horrible overrunning of a region by evil, God brought the flood upon the whole world. So Sodom and Gomorrah, they are a hotbed of evil. And I wonder, again, this is just my opinion, just throwing it out there for you to chew on, I wonder whether or not the fallen angels had been messing around with humankind in the area around Sodom and Gomorrah, trying to come up with more plans of hybrids, just like they did before the flood. Because we know Moses told us that there were giants in the days before the flood, just as there were giants after the flood. And so this is the place he seems to have been thinking about for after the flood. So I wonder whether or not we've got these giant groups that are coming outward from the Sodom and Gomorrah region. We know that there's also another group of them that ends up going over toward where Abram is currently living, and that's by Hebron. Now, they'll be there in the time of Joshua, but right now they seem to perhaps be in the same area of Sodom and Gomorrah. But they're still not done. The alliance is still following the royal highway south. And verse number 6 says that they next defeated the Horites in their hill country of Seir, as far as El Paran on the border of the wilderness. Now, Mount Seir, we know exactly where that's at. It is a mountainous region to the south and east of the bottom of the Dead Sea, as it existed in the time of Moses. And it's the place where Esau is going to eventually live, and it'll take his nickname of Edom. So that region right there is what we're talking about. El Paran is probably a reference to the Paran that is down toward the Gulf of Aqaba. The whole region is called the Wilderness of Paran, and so El Paran is probably a high point that's down in that area. Now, the Horites, they have an interesting name. It's not related to any type of giant groups that we know. They are referred to as the cave dwellers. That's what Horite means. And it will be the Horites that Esau marries into and then pretty much becomes the leader of later in our story in the book of Genesis, in that exact same region. So these are the precursors of the ethnic group that Esau marries into. And they are defeated by this advancing alliance of kings out of Mesopotamia. And then it says next that they turned back, verse number 7, and came to En-Mishpat, that is Kadesh, and defeated all the country of the Amalekites and also the Amorites who were dwelling in Hazazon Tamar. Now, En-Mishpat or Kadesh, I believe, is located about midway between the Gulf of Aqaba and the south tip of what was the Dead Sea in the time of Moses. Kadesh was the entry point for Egypt, if you're coming from Egypt along the Royal Highway and then turned north at the Gulf of Aqaba, it would be the entry point into Canaan. It was the gateway city, probably right there by some sort of water source. And this is the next place that the alliance attacks and takes control of. And if you get a map out, what you will see is every time that they have fought some group and taken control, they're making basically a little J-hook around what was, in Moses' day, the Salt Sea or the Dead Sea, where in Abram's day, Sodom and Gomorrah and the other cities were located. So they are controlling all of the area around the region that they plan on attacking. And probably at each place, they left some sort of occupying force to try to control that region. So they're doing good strategic placement of all these attacks. Now, the last place that we're mentioning here that they attacked was Hazazon Tamar. Later in the Old Testament, we find out that that is equivalent with En-Gedi. En-Gedi is located about the midpoint on the west shore of the Dead Sea. I've been there. It's a very interesting place. It's very desolate now. It's part of the Judean wilderness. There is this water source that's falling out of, and I mean that literally, it's falling out of the hills of Judea, the hills of ancient Canaan. And it's an erosion zone that you can see a lot of degradation of the rocks and all of that over a period of time. As it's coming down from the high point up in the hundreds of feet above sea level till it finally pours into the Dead Sea over 1,000 feet below sea level. My guess, based on the thesis that I keep sharing with you, that the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah changed all the geography around here, is that En-Gedi was a water source, pretty much where the waterfalls are at En-Gedi today, that would have been immediately west of the Valley of Siddim, or the valley where Sodom and Gomorrah and the all other cities are located. And if that is the case, then this invading force, has accomplished this J-hook right around to the west side of where they're going to attack. And if they have placed perhaps another force to the north in the Jordan Valley, then they have completely enveloped the Valley of Siddim and made it where they can attack it easily with great success that's going to come out of this. And so we read next this, verse number 8. Then the king of Sodom, the king of Gomorrah, the king of Admah, the king of Zeboim and the king of Bela, that is Zoar, just always a reminder that that will eventually be the city of Zoar, went out and they joined battle in the valley of Siddim. Now, this is another one of my reasons for thinking the north basin of the Dead Sea didn't even exist at this time. Because there's nothing here about them going around the Dead Sea in order to engage the forces that are at En Gedi. It just simply says they head straight across. And so, and it even says that they go into the Valley of Siddim. So this area that is now the Dead Sea North Basin used to be a well-watered agricultural area, probably above sea level, that's my guess, and full of little bitumen pits, places where the petroleum is just pumping right straight to the surface under its own pressure. And so they joined forces right there with Chedorlaomer, king of Elam, Tidal, of king of Goyim, Amraphel, king of Shinar, and Arioch, king of Elasar, four kings against five. Now, the valley of Siddim, I should say that more properly, the valley of fields, was full of bitumen pits. And as the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah fled, because you see, they got beat, they are routed. And so they do what is most natural in a rout. You retreat. You go back the way you came from, which is going to be heading east. And as they're in full retreat, some of them fell into these bitumen pits. And if you want to have a more modern way of thinking about these bitumen pits, if you've ever been to Los Angeles and visited the La Brea tar pits, that's how you should think of this. So there's places like that amidst the greenery, amidst some of the fields that are being cultivated. And you may not know when you're running full tilt trying to get away until the last second that you're falling into one of these. And once you have, you're in a mess. I mean, that's how we've found all sorts of preserved animal bones in the La Brea tar pits, because they got caught into them. So those that are not casualties falling into the tar pits, it says the rest fled into the hill country. And the hill country that is in mind here would be the hill country east of the Dead Sea, what we would call Moab later in our historical studies. Verse 11, so the enemy took all the possessions of Sodom and Gomorrah and all their provisions and went their way. And so basically the cities get abandoned. The forces go in and take the stuff they want because, you know, they hadn't been paid their tribute for this year nor last year. So they just take everything and then they leave. And it wasn't just stuff and animals that they took. Verse 12, they also took Lot, the son of Abram's brother, who was dwelling in Sodom, and his possessions, and went their way. Now, this is where we find out that Lot actually moved into Sodom at some point in the last few years. He had a tent up in the Jordan Valley north of this area. Then he moved that tent closer and closer to Sodom. And now he's apparently living in the city itself. And that is why he ends up being taken hostage. And he's being taken away probably either to be sold back to his family members later, or more likely he's just been taken away as a slave force that can be sold on the markets up in Mesopotamia. Verse 13. Then one who had escaped came and told Abram the Hebrew. So somebody related to Lot or associated with Lot who sees him captured and taken away, knows he has an uncle that's only about 20 or so miles away, off behind where the attack came from. So this refugee apparently makes a run either north or south around the attacking forces and runs off to tell Abram, your nephew is in trouble. You need to rescue him. So then the one who had escaped came and told Abram the Hebrew. And this is where we see Hebrew used for the first time as a designation for Abram and all those descended from him. It goes back to Eber, who was apparently the member of this family line that was alive when the Tower of Babel occurred, which means it was his family group that had the Hebrew language the first time. And so Abram is speaking that particular language or dialect, and that's why he has that term attached to him here. Who was living by the oaks of Mamre, the Amorite, brother of Eshcol and of Aner. So this is where we find about the three brothers that Abram is in alliance with, right there close to where Hebron is going to be eventually. These were allies of Abram. When Abram heard that his kinsmen had been taken captive, he led forth his trained men born in his house, 318 of them, and went in pursuit as far as Dan. Now, this is the first time we find out a solid number of people working for Abram. He's got 318 men, able-bodied, who apparently were actually born and raised in his service. So this is not the number total of guys that he has working for him. This is a small number of those who have grown up in his service working for him. So he's got a lot of people on the payroll. And we should always keep that in mind when we try to picture what his encampment looked like. It wouldn't have been one or two little tents here and there. It would have been a very busy tent city with all the people working for him. So these are able-bodied men who are capable to function as a militia force. And they're not going to be alone, because we find out later that Abram's three allies go with him. And they most certainly, as wealthy men, would have had their own servants and workers. And they would have had militia members as well. So if each of the three allies of Abram had only 100 of their own militia members, then that means that Abram would have been taking somewhere around 600 fighting men on this foray north. And that would be equivalent to our modern battalion. Now, if each of his friends had pretty much the same number as he has militia members, then that's going to put the fighting force to about 1,200 members. That would be a full modern regiment. So this is not some sort of small, piddly posse that's being put together here. This is a serious army. And they go north to where Dan is located. Now, back at this time, it would have been a community, I think, called Luz, if it even existed at this time. That's about 130 miles north of where Abram is living. So it's going to take them several days that's going to make this trip by foot. And they are trying to pursue this retreating, I guess I shouldn't say retreating, this returning military force of the Mesopotamians. And they catch up with them at Dan. Now, when we made the trip to Israel last year, and actually I did this the year before as well, at Dan, where we go. And I hope you'll go with me. If you haven't made those arrangements, check on the website and get everything you need and get that done. There is a gate still in existence that's been uncovered from roughly this same time period. So you can actually still see the remnants of the city that Abram might have come right past in order to attack these Mesopotamian forces. Verse 15, he divided his forces against them by night, so he chooses to make a night ambush. Now, you would use this if you were going against a larger force than your own. So even though he might have like a battalion or a regiment-sized militia, the other side might be even larger still. So this type of attack might be his safest bet. So he waits and attacks them by night, he and his servants, and he defeated them and pursued them to Hobah, north of Damascus. Now, we don't know where Hobah is, but if it's north of Damascus, then we've probably got 20, 30, maybe 40 miles that they fight against this retreating Mesopotamian force now. And they severely hurt them. And I think it's possible that they might have weakened the military of Mesopotamia, and that might have allowed Ur III to come even more powerful into the power vacuum that happened. But he basically recovers everything. Verse 16, he brought back all the possessions and also brought back his kinsman Lot with his possessions and the women and the people. And so it's been a very successful operation, but we've run out of time. So we have to wait until tomorrow to talk about what happens next.